Welcome to the Practical Revitalization Podcast. We look at revitalization in real time, examining the ups and downs of revitalizing and replanting historic and legacy churches throughout New England and the U.S. Now here's your hosts.
Hey everyone, it's Don McKinnon of Legacy Church, and welcome back to the Practical Revitalization Podcast. We are in a series right now. I don't know how to quite group this series, but you know, there's just so much going on. I think we could do different takes. Like, I'm wondering how all your churches are doing with the, I don't know if I'd call it a crisis, but I know our church is feeling it. I know a number of other churches in my area are feeling everything with the giving right now because of because of the inflation, and I'm wondering how that is. I recently was interviewed for an article that was in the Deseret Times, was able to kind of express a little bit there, but you know, it's one of those things of just trusting God, and being willing to accept when God wants to do things that may go against what we want to do or we want to believe is the way, but just trusting God right now. Anyway, so last week we were discussing groupthink, and so I was going to only do one of these, and I decided this could actually be broken up into a series of three. So last week we talked about the symptoms of groupthink and how groupthink could be affecting the church and affecting people's thinking within the church. And we want to now focus on causes today. And causes are an interesting thing. Irving Janis is the one that did this thing in wrote a thing in 1972 about victims of groupthink, and it was a psychological study in the decision-making process for groupthink. And so, you know, when we look at how groupthink, the symptoms were, and they broke those symptoms down into three types, and there were eight symptoms altogether that Janis wrote in that one, which I didn't give Janis credit last week, so my bad. But in this, Janis identified three antidotal conditions to groupthink. And so we're going to focus on these three things in this episode, because I think that if we understand and if we start to roll out and look at different things within the church, I believe really wholeheartedly looking at like the life expectancy of a church and looking at cycles that happen naturally and looking at then causes and all sorts of things, we can kind of begin to develop a new treatment, maybe. You know, it's not that what's out there is bad, but maybe what's out there, there's some other things that we can do. Maybe there's a couple of things that people are trying to do which will never work, or if people see that it works but it takes too long, maybe there are things that we can correct in those. So that's what I want to focus on, and that's why we're going to look at the causes today of groupthink. So the first thing that Janis identifies as an antidote is high group cohesiveness. And basically, what he's saying in here is that the main factor in groupthink is cohesiveness. When groups lack that cohesiveness, they, of course, are going to make bad decisions, but they do not experience groupthink. In other words, in a cohesive group, members avoid speaking out against decisions and avoid arguing with others, working towards maintaining friendly relationships in the group. So we think about that. Within the groupthink scenario, it's like we don't want to make arguments. We don't like to feel discomfort. We don't like to be challenged. You know, there's different things that go on there. And those are the things that I think when we can focus on those things and point these things out, these things can really begin to challenge and begin to work things out towards a better factor. It's, in other words, like we're looking at this and we know that people don't like to bring up something that needs to be changed within church. Let's say swapping out pews for pew chairs, that becomes a heated debate, and so people will not like to bring that up. And so that's where this ends up. They're trying to maintain the friendliness of the relationships, but if the cohesiveness gets to such a level that there is no longer disagreements between the groups, then the group is ripe for groupthink. So in other words, nothing's ever going to change, and what needs to change is going to never change. If people know that something has to be done, they don't like to challenge. They don't like to say, hey, you know, it's kind of like that thing where, you know, there's the old saying where if the pastor is never attacked, you know, in other words, there are people who are in agreement with the pastor all the time, then get out of the church, because the pastor should be having disagreements and should be having some conflicts in there, because you to change people is a constant process, and the Bible is rich in that discussion. When we think about it, you know, the potter and the clay, it's talking about us being the clay and God being the potter and trying to mold us into what he wants, but the clay wants to do what it will do. So we don't like to change, and that's the natural thing that happens within revitalizations. We don't like to change. So we look at this, and there is one of the subparts that Janice talks about is the de-individuation. The group cohesiveness becomes more important than individual freedom of expression. So in other words, you can't have that one person that says we should be doing that. It becomes you know, like everybody's got to be in agreement. Now, theologically, yes, but in a church, you know, we've heard the saying, the modes change, but the gospel stays the same. So if a person comes in and says, we need to do this, we shouldn't be arguing. We should be like listening to the story and understanding what's going on within it. The other thing that Janice talks about is illusions of unanimity. Members perceive falsely that everyone agrees with the group's decision. Silence is seen as consent. So Janice noted that the unity of a group members was a mere illusion. Members may disagree with the organization's decision, but go along with the group for many reasons, such as maintaining their group status and avoiding conflict with the people in charge or fellow peers. So these members think that suggesting options contrary to the others will lead to isolation. So in other words, people aren't, you know, they just don't want to bring it up. And I think that becomes constant within a revitalization, that we see where people are trying to make the proper decisions. They may have questions. They may think that something needs to be discussed. And that's where a lot of the problems happen, a lot of things, a lot of disagreements. Nobody wants to talk. And a lot of revitalizations see this, and people, rather than talk, will turn around and leave a church rather than discuss and bring up these conversations. So it becomes one of those things where I think I do think that we hear it, that disagreements is healthy. Some people, I remember years ago, there was the big debate among psychologists where marriage counselors would say some arguments are healthy for a marriage, and you would have the people that now would say, oh no, you shouldn't be disagreeing in your marriage. And I mean, while you get along in your marriage, your disagreements aren't going to happen as much because the two of you are going to have spent more time together. But early on in a marriage, you're going to have disagreements, and those are healthy because those are showing the individualism. Those are showing the things that people may not understand about one another. And this is where, if we're honest, when it comes to living together before marriage, you know, they have the option of leaving rather than working out the situation. But in a marriage, you want to work out the situation. Same thing is within the church. You want to be able to work out the situations that exist with the conflict. If you don't have the conflict, there's nothing there that will really help a church understand its meaning and its plan, and a pastor sharing the vision without the people questioning why the vision is this. So we need to understand that. The second cause, anecdotal cause, condition of groupthink, according to Janice, is structural faults. So in other words, what he's saying here is the group is organized in ways that disrupt the communication of information, or the group carelessly makes decisions. Now, that's something that we can understand. I think there's been situations in my own running of the church where some of that happens, and it's like you kind of want a mulligan and take it back and rework it. But that is the thing, is that the organization needs to be able to communicate clearly with stuff so that the decisions made by the group are for the health of the group and not for the likes and dislikes of the group. We look into this, and one of the things that he talks about is there is an insulation of the group, that this can promote the development of unique, inaccurate perspectives on issues the group is dealing with, which can then lead to faulty solutions to the problem. So, in other words, if somebody is sitting there saying there is this issue within the church, and there is no group, there is no dialogue. So one thing I think a lot of churches, especially in revitalizations, don't like is group meetings, you know, the church meetings. And you have to have church meetings. You have to bring it together. And the one thing that I know that needs to be done at times is you need to have a meeting, have a discussion, have somebody say, do we have an answer to this? And then be able to say, okay, we're going to table this for now and come back in a month and we're going to have the information on this. And so that way there you can come back and have the information on this and be able to discuss it with the whole group so the whole group understands what's out there. In some of these cases, you might say, okay, let's table this for now and come back to it. But what we're going to do is we're going to come back and we're going to not just table the conversation for now, but we are going to make it in such a way that we want you to understand that there's other churches that are dealing with this situation. So then you might sit there and bring in a pastor or a denominational leader or somebody that can sit there and say, yes, this has happened before, and this is how we dealt with it. So that way there, the information is there, and you're getting an outside perspective so that it breaks up that groupthink and it helps to form a solve a problem solidly so that there is no fault in it. The other thing that he talks about within this is there is a lack of impartial leadership. Leaders control the group discussion by planning what will be discussed, allowing only certain questions to be asked, and asking for opinions of only certain people in the group. A closed style leadership is when leaders announce their opinions on the issue before the group discusses the issue together. In an open style leadership, leadership is when leaders withhold their opinion until a later time in the discussion. Groups with a closed style leader are more biased in their judgments, especially when members had a high degree of certainty. So in other words, what he's saying here is we don't want to have leaders who are the be-all and end-all and the only subject matter, but that we're trying to come together to ask those questions, and people need to have the information to be able to discuss the questions together. Another thing that he talks about is the lack of norms requiring methodological procedures. So in other words, there is no, like I said, let's table this and everybody go out and find something. I've heard of situations where a pastor went out and got somebody to come in and discuss, and then one of the members got another pastor to come in and discuss, and it actually led to a very interesting 3-hour discussion on the subject for this church, which really led to about 6 months more of working out the issues. But what ended up happening is in the long run, several years later, this church is very solid, very strong, and has all its stuff figured out. The other thing is understanding the members' social backgrounds and ideology. So a lot of people, they come together, and some people, they think that because they lack something, because they may come from a background where they don't have money or influence or education or anything, they have no voice. And what we have to understand is if we're in a church, everyone has a voice, because the church is not the building, the church is the people. And if the church is the people, then everyone has a voice. Everyone has something to say. Elders lead in the teaching of the word, but we also have to understand that within the group, people are going to want to know about certain things, and we can see where a lot of things begin to fall apart over time within those. The third thing that he talks about is the situational context. Highly stressful external threats. So this is the third anecdotal condition, which is situational context. And the first point on this is highly stressful external threats. So high stakes decisions can create tension and anxiety. Group members may cope with this stress in irrational ways. Group members may rationalize their decision by exaggerating the positive consequences and minimizing the possible negative consequences in attempt to minimize the stressful situation. The group decides quickly and allows little to no decision or disagreement. Groups under high stress are more likely to make errors, lose focus on the ultimate goal, and use procedures that members know have not been effective in the past. So this is one of those things, like this is something where I would say for me personally, if I were to use this, is knowing that I need something in our church other than Sundays to disciple people. And we have tried several times to do midweek groups, midweek Bible study, just different things, and it doesn't work. A lot of the time, it's because I'm trying to put it together and launch it within, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. And really, coming to a point of discussion with a number of people in our organization and outside the organization, I've come to realize that there's a lot more that needs to be thought of. And so we've been working out this process. And one thing that we're heavily leaning towards is bringing back Sunday school, because one of the issues in doing our studies has been that it starts out like gangbusters, but then loses all the momentum going forward. Whereas, you know, Sundays, people, if they want to learn, they're going to get there a little bit earlier to learn and just go from there. So that's the thing that we're leaning towards, is that we may see people stick around. It's something easy because it's not adding another day. It's just adding a little more time to a day that's usually busy, and going from there, and then seeing how this will work for other people in other situations. In other words, you know, eventually maybe this leads to a Saturday or Friday night or, you know, some other time of the week where the people get together to meet. We look at recent failures, and these can lead to low self-esteem, resulting in agreement with the group for fear of being seen as wrong. So you think about it, how many times that something has launched and fails, and we just, yeah, that ain't going to work. You know, I wanted to bring back a midweek service. I still think that a midweek service will work. But if I were to say, let's do it now, I think our church would say no. And I think that what we have to do is we have to look at these things and say, this is where we're going to go. This is how we have to go. This is where we're going to go, and bring it forward. So I think, you know, like once again, if the Sunday school works, then the next obvious thing would be bringing back something midweek, whether it's a midweek service or a midweek study, to really push people in that direction. The other thing is excessive difficulties in decision-making tasks. So, you know, something has to be done. A lot of people don't want to make the decision process right away. And so there's, like, difficulties in it. You know, well, what about, you know, how many times have we heard that where somebody's like, well, what about X? What about Y? What about Z? And they keep pushing it. You think about the whole scenario on a TV show where the girl that really likes the guy is trying to say it, and you know they make a big comedy thing about their indecisiveness. You know, that is the problem that they're talking about there. you can, you know, take too much time making that decision making, that the effectiveness has now surpassed, the perfect launch time has now passed, and it will fail. The other thing is time pressures. Group members are more concerned with efficiency and quick results than the quality and accuracy. So in other words, people, you know, we think about it, the church growth movement, people want to see people come into church. Well, that's great, but what's going to happen is people sometimes see people come into the church and want to accept these people in right away and all sorts of stuff, and that's like, you know, not understandable. It's not acceptable. What we have to do is we want to make sure that these people really are the right fit for the church. I think of too many churches, even me in recent times, we have had people come in and we thought that these people would be a good fit for something. And we're either A, not the church that they're looking for, you know, they want more in the church, or B, they want to take the church over themselves. So this is the thing that we have to understand with the quality and accuracy. And the time pressures can lead group members to overlook important information. So, you know, some people are going to sit there and they're going to look at how a church is dealing with a situation, you know, how people are coming in. If those people have ulterior motives to what they are planning to do, that's going to cause issues. So we want to be aware of that. The last thing is moral dilemmas, and you know, those are the ethical things. You know, what are we doing? You know, are we, you know, is a church bringing in people? Or is the church doing things which is going against the church's own theological leanings? You know, a lot of times that happens. A lot of times we have to come to understand that a church has things that just is not right, you know, in making those decision processes that, you know, Are we, you know, really looking at people to teach or to do other things based for the right reasons? And yeah, it just goes into so much in on so many levels there. So we need to really think about that. And like I said, the biggest thing I think is that a church can make decisions where it goes against the theological leaning of the church and needs to really think about it and lead it. So with all of this, we have to come to understand that although it is possible for a situation to contain all three of these factors, all three are not always present, even when groupthink is occurring. And Janus considered a high degree of cohesiveness to be the most important antidote to producing groupthink, and always present when groupthink was occurring. However, he believed high cohesiveness would not always produce groupthink. A very cohesive group abides with all group norms. So, in other words, there's things that we have to be careful of. We have to understand that, you know, things are going to be normal for a group to do. And so we can't think within the group think, but we have to understand that things are going to happen and on a natural way that is not a cause of groupthink. In other words, you know, I would say, like, if you are living in a state and you have a really good football team, You know, it's not going to be groupthink for everybody to think that the team is doing good. In fact, that team might be doing good, but y'all might just disagree with how the coaching or the drafting or anything is going to be done. And if you know where I'm from, you know that's what's been going on lately here with a certain football team. But that's what he was discussing in that. And if the group encourages individual dissent and alternative strategies to problem solving, it is likely that groupthink will be avoided, even in a highly cohesive group. So in other words, you know, if you're willing to listen to what a person is saying, that's going to be good, because it can bring in that different thought, and it shows that not everybody is in 100% agreement. I don't think you're going to find a church that's in 100% agreement with certain things. And this means that the high cohesion will lead to groupthink only if one or both of the other antidotes are present. Situational context being slightly more likely than structural faults to groupthink. So there's a lot to take in there, but the basic part is that you know, it's too much for us to just think that certain things are going to happen for a certain reason, but in the overall thing, looking at these things, understanding these things, and making sure that we're using preventative measures to keep out of the groupthink. And I think pastors need to, you know, really emphasize that, hey, we're having a meeting to discuss this. We'd like you to be there with your opinion. You know, we want to use language like that to really help our people understand what's going on and how we're thinking in these things. So that's it. That's another short episode, and I'm going to say we'll be back next week with part 3, which is the prevention methods. So with that, I'm going to say goodbye.